Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Well, they're calling you a chick, and the name just seems to stick, and you still don't think you're living in a cage. Have you heard? A tree. Did you ever think that you were up a tree? Well, they're calling you a name that makes you their fair game, and you still don't think that you are up a tree.
Good afternoon, it's 12:04, and this is the Women's Consciousness Raising Hour. I'm Diane Trombley. It seems to me that there is always a tendency to look at any political movement, whether it's socialism, vegetarianism, or feminism, as a monolithic structure with one philosophy, one goal, and one strategy. Over the last several weeks, I've been trying to provide you with voices of various women who have a variety of viewpoints. Today, we're going to continue with another voice, which some of you may not be familiar with. We'll be hearing from Bertha Harris. She's a lesbian writer, as well as the director of women's studies at the City University of New York. She'll be talking about women writers in Paris during the 1920s. But first, let's listen to some music.
I want to dedicate this song to McGeorge Bundy, to Robert McNamara, to Lyndon Baines Johnson, and to the memory of John Foster Dulles.
Well, you got to read.
You got to read.
Just what you saw.
Just what you saw.
Boy, you got to read.
You got to read.
Just what you saw.
Just what you saw.
You may sow it in the day, but you will reap it anyway. You got to.
You got to reap just what you sow. What you sow.
You got to reap.
You got to reap.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You got to reap.
You got. got to reap
just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You may sow it in the night, but you're gonna reap it in the light. You're gonna reap.
You got to reap just what you sow. What you sow.
Oh, you got to reap.
You got to reap
just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Yeah, you got to reap.
You got to reap
just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You may sow it in the rain, but you're gonna reap it just the same. Oh, yes, you got to reap.
You got to reap
just what you sow.
What you sow.
Mick George Bundy got to reap.
You got to reap
just what he sow.
Just what you sow.
Mr. Johnson got to reap.
You got to reap
just what they sow.
Just what you sow.
Oh, Mr. Johnson got to reap. But in the meantime, he cannot sleep. You know he got to reap.
You got to reap
just what he sow.
What you sow.
Oh, yes, you got to reap. Oh, you got to reap just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Yes, you got to reap.
You got to reap
just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Oh, you may sow it in the night, but you got to reap it in the light. You gotta reap, oh, you got to reap
just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Friends
this song to McGeorge Bundy, to Robert McNamara, to Lyndon Baines Johnson, and to the memory of John Foster Dulles.
Well, you got to reap.
You got to reap.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Boy, you got to reap.
You got to reap.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You may sow it in the day, but you will reap it anyway. You got to reap.
You got to reap just what you sow. What you sow.
You got to reap.
You got to reap.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You got to reap.
You got to reap.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
You may sow it in the night, but you're gonna reap it in the light. You're gonna reap.
You got to reap just what you sow.
Joe Working Man's wife. That's how I was defined. As if that was my life, my hope and my mind. But I worked in a bake shop, did the housework at night, and there was no time to stop for a young bird in flight. Well, in time there were babies, and I had to make us a home. Joe was working two jobs, and I was always alone. I needed some time and just a little control, just to keep my right mind, just to try to stay whole. I wanted a partner to be his friend, not just his wife. I work hard for my children, but they're my love, not my life. In this world, my kids are in high school, and don't you know the boss calls me girl? But the woman beside me, as we sweat out the line, says tomorrow. And the next day is mine. It's a race for the strong, 'cause it'll grind up the meek. When your money runs short, about the end of a week, and your car needs some tires, that's an old kind of blues. Now this system buys hands, but you must not use your head. It'll shake you and break you. Till all your senses are dead.
to get to the source. I think me and this system got to get a divorce. I can't make enough money. More where I come from. Yeah, and we got anger to burn, but we're talking and moving. We're gonna study and learn, build a unity train. Today is the boss's. I know tomorrow is mine. And I know it takes loving. And I know it takes time. But I'm a working class woman. And the future is mine.
As I mentioned earlier, today we'll be listening to an interview with Bertha Harris, done by Victoria Brownworth. For those of you who may have just joined us, Bertha Harris is a lesbian writer and director of women's studies at the City University of New York. Her topic will be about the interesting, though not widely known, group of women writers and artists living in Paris during the 1920s. Among these women were Gina Barnes, Romaine Brooks, the painter, Natalie Clifford Barney, and, of course, Renée Vivienne. She'll also have some perceptive comments on some present-day feminist writers, such as June Arnold, Doris Lessing, Rita Mae Brown, and Virginia Woolf. So let's listen now to Victoria Brownworth's interview with Bertha Harris.
Today I'm speaking with Bertha Harris, author of Catching Sarah Dove, Confessions of Cherubino, and Lover, and most recently an article in Christopher Street on the women in Paris in the 20s, writers in Paris. I'd like to know what you see writing as meaning to you, what it's representative of for you, and if you see it as a means of education.
Well, I have to go back a little bit. Writing started out for me is when I look back on it now, as a means of freedom. A place to go that would get away from that would get me away from my family and the really ghastly environment of a place called Fayetteville, North Carolina. As much as I wanted it to, I hesitate to use the word escape because it was not an escape process in the way that people generally use that word. It was not like blowing your brains out or burning your brains out with the soap operas.
Maybe
of
retreat
the
is a better word.
Yeah, but it opened up places to go, and it began to define my life and everything I wanted to do with my life. I see it, and I suppose I've done this through three novels, but with increasing consciousness of what I wanted to do. And now I think I'm entirely conscious of how I want to use fiction. It's not explicitly or primarily, I think, a means of education. I would like it to begin to define what a lesbian is, what the lesbian sensibility is, what the possibilities of being a lesbian are, of course, in a dramatic form rather than a expository form. I rely on fantasy a lot because I think in a world that is explicitly male and male dominated and heterosexual, a lot of lesbians live in their heads. In fact, that's perhaps where our true life goes on outside the little subculture we inhabit in a group or with our lovers. So particularly in this latest book, Lover, I think I've tried to, by plunging into my own dreams and fantasies, to hopefully universalize them and also exaggerate in many ways areas of relationships that I think might possibly be there were we not in a patriarchy, were we not living in a place where it is not only dangerous but threatening to be lesbian. For instance, towards the end of this novel I have this huge collection of women all the way through the book, but I have a woman who is the grandmother who suddenly realizes that she is in love with her granddaughter. And it occurred to me to mention that because a review in the Denver feminist newspaper, Big Mama Rag, was a very funny review. And the woman who wrote the review said, "My God, can you imagine a grandmother in love with her granddaughter?" But after going through the whole process of this book, I realized that this character could indeed not merely love, but be romantically in love with her granddaughter. And it was happening in a world that I'd taken outside the real world. It has all the usual accoutrements, like trees and houses and so forth. It's not a science fiction book, but I realized it could happen that Samaria could indeed fall in love with Flynn, and so forth.
In terms of patriarchy, do you feel that that has a really decided effect on what women are writing?
Well, I think it does in two ways, for the most part, two big general ways, although there are lots of little subdivisions under this. I think women's fiction, and I'll confine myself to that for the most part since I know it best, is post-feminism, and I'm including that post-feminist lesbian fiction is of two kinds. It's either reacting against patriarchal modes in literature, deliberately and consciously, or else it is retreating into the very rich, full world that too is a reaction, but it's more of it's reaction plus something else. It's not social realism, for instance. It interests me because, for instance, I see straight feminists like Marge Piercy writing more and more what I would describe as social realism, even though her latest book we're supposed to assume it's science fiction, but it really isn't.
No,
it relies again on the accoutrements of the patriarchy and reactions to it and struggling with it. I think the best dyke fiction is refusing gradually to struggle with patriarchy anymore. It's stepping outside that culture and that psychology and those politics. Joanna Russ's science fiction novel, The Female Man, I consider one of the best syntheses of good radical politics, imagination, intellectual behavior, and giving it intellectual pleasure along with the usual things that fiction does.
Do you feel that one of your interests in the Parisian set in the 20s has to do with escaping from patriarchal confines in literature?
Yeah, when I first became interested in that, I think I was about 21 years old, and I'd gone through that that whole education of the young woman number, in which with a perfectly good English major under my belt, I had never read a single woman author throughout the whole shtick, except for Jane Austen, which was taught by a little old lady that nobody took seriously. And it was the usual crap: Hemingway, Joyce, and then the other good old boys, you know, Shakespeare, Chaucer, and so forth. So,
but extremely patriarchal.
Extremely patriarchal. Yeah. So that when I think it was exam week of my senior year, I stumbled across a book that had last been checked out in a college library in 1940. And it was called Nightwood by Juno Barnes. And it absolutely
devastated
me. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I thought, my God, this is it. And went straight to New York and found out that Juno Barnes lived in Greenwich Village in a little muse place called Patchin Place. And I spent every minute away from my typing job following her around the street.
That must have been fascinating. Oh,
yes. She became my hero. She began to represent what I wanted to be. And from her, I moved on to finding clues and glimmerings of what that group in Paris had been about.
The thing that fascinates me about that particular set of people is that they were all so incredibly talented, and not just talented, but really ahead of their time. Romaine Brooks' paintings are her drawings are, you know, really precursors of the things that Picasso, you know, was made famous for. Natalie Barney was an amazing woman with just an incredible knowledge of everything. And Renée Vivien is an excellent poet, was an excellent poet, despite her bizarre emotional problems. But I think that one of the things that you're talking about is the lack of models for women, especially lesbian women. And I'd like to know what you hope lesbian fiction would accomplish in that area.
Well, for instance, I would like to see the works of Natalie Clifford Barney and Renée Vivien disseminated far more widely than they are now. In fact, I'd like to see them.
Well, they're practically non-existent.
Well, there's some bit of good news, because Naiad Press, the lesbian press that was a offshoot from the old Ladder, which was the only lesbian publication for so many years, has recently reissued, in fact, today's practically publication day, of the only novel that Renée Vivien ever wrote. Which translated is entitled The Woman Who Appeared to Me. And it's a very romantic, perfumed hothouse type of style, but it contains some of the most devastatingly revolutionary remarks I've ever read. In fact, it's the natural mother, if she had only known it, of Valerie Solanas when she wrote Scum Manifesto. But I'd much rather see, for instance, these books. I'd like to see not only Renée's novel, but her poetry and Natalie Clifford Barney's work translated and brought into the mass market. But much more so than, say, some of the lesbian writers who have entered more or less the mainstream now, whose work I don't particularly respect, like Mae Sarton, who has become a popular favorite. Her work, for instance, is very sugary, sentimental. It has none of that toughness and strength and acerbity that...
Well, also just, you know, the tightness of the literary accoutrements that other people like Gina Barnes has had. I mean, she has such a marvelous control over the short story. Mm-hmm. I mean, she can say more in 3 pages of a short story than a lot of novelists I've read. And one of the problems that I have with current lesbian fiction is that it doesn't, it's sort of riding in on the wave of,
right,
of the lesbian movement. And I think that one of the things we need to do is sort out what's good and what isn't.